Good afternoon. Call our third case for today, 10 AP 1937, OA, Wisconsin Prosperity Network et al. Versus Gordon Mize et al. And I have as the lineup for oral argument 25 minutes for Attorney Essenberg, 20 minutes for Attorney, is it Bellavia? Pardon me? Bellavia. Thank you. 10 minutes for Attorney O'Neill and 5 minutes in rebuttal for Mr. Essenberg. Agreed upon? All right. Then it's your turn, Attorney Essenberg.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Richard M. Essenberg, the Wisconsin Institute of Law for Law and Liberty. With me at council table is my colleague Thomas Kamenick. Present in the courtroom here today are co-counsel Sarah Troupas from the Troupas Law Offices and Michael Dean of the First Freedoms Foundation.
You're representing all the petitioners?
We're representing all of the petitioners.
Okay. Thank you.
This is a case that is about overreach. It's about whether the GAB can promulgate a rule which will impose the registration, reporting, accounting, oath, identification, disclaimer, and fee requirements on just about any speaker who wishes to comment on the behavior of a public official at just about any time, as long as that speaker spends as little as $25 to speak. The problem, the root of the problem with GAB 128 is resident in two developments. First, the rule extends the reach of these requirements for the first time to issue advocacy, moving beyond the definition of express advocacy.
Counsel, isn't that one of the issues about how you interpret it, whether or not this covers issue advocacy or only express advocacy?
That is one of the issues.
Okay. And your position is that it covers both. Is that right?
Our position is that it covers both express and issue advocacy, and that, in fact, it is sufficiently broad and vague so that a speaker will not know where the line is drawn.
Right. Well, does your overbroad theory or vagueness theory cover whether it's express advocacy or issue advocacy or both?
If the speech is express advocacy, then the rule needs to be limited to the definition that is set forth in Wisconsin Right to Life 2. The problem with both the original and revised versions of 128 is that they depart from this definition, so that a speaker who wishes to engage in what he or she might regard as issue advocacy has no way to be certain that not only the Government Accountability Board, but a district attorney in any one of 72 counties across this state might ultimately conclude that his or her speech is within the reach of these multiple requirements imposed by the rule.
And I assume that that's the same argument for issue advocacy or not?
That's the same argument with respect to issue advocacy. That is correct.
And you're making a facial challenge?
We're making a facial challenge
on both
issue and express advocacy, although in our view of the case, Chief Justice Abrahamson, the overbreadth with respect to the scope of the rule and the speech that it relates to is intertwined with the overbreadth of the rule with respect to the type of speaker that it applies to. That the rule will apply to someone who spends as little as $25 on advocacy. And so these requirements now will potentially apply to the farmer who paints a message on the side of his barn calling on his neighbors to oppose Senator Erpenbach's desertion. Will apply potentially to a resident of Madison who spends more than $25 to fashion homemade yard signs or signs to be held at a demonstration calling for the recall of Scott Walker.
Counsel, all those are in the statute, right?
They're They're all in the statute.
Right. Your objection is that 128 expands who is covered. Isn't that your point?
It expands its coverage in that up until this point.
But you're not challenging the statute.
We're not challenging the statute. Up to this point, the statute would have applied only to people who are engaged in express advocacy, okay, using the express language, that is,
correct,
vote for or vote against a
so
particular candidate.
So if this only covers express advocacy within the constitutional parameters of express advocacy, you're not challenging the statute.
That's correct,
okay,
at this point.
Just wanted to check that.
Well, just as follow-up, you're not challenging the statute at all here today. You're challenging 1.28, and it's a facial challenge. Is
absolutely.
That correct?
We're challenging the statute as it is applied in the rule. That is, its extension.
You're challenging the rule as being broader than the statute. That's your power argument, which is your second argument. And you're challenging the rule as being unconstitutional, as broader than what the U.S. Supreme Court has allowed.
Right.
Isn't that right?
That's right. And we would also argue broader than what the Wisconsin State Constitution ought to be interpreted.
Right. That's another, that's the third argument.
That's right.
From my counting, but might not be the same as your counting. Go ahead.
All right.
Mr. Essenberg, before you go ahead, are you asking us to do a limiting construction as far as 1.28?
No, because I think a limiting construction in the speech area has to be fairly inferable from the language of the rule itself. And the reason is, particularly, and again, for us, the scope of the speech that is affected by the rule is intertwined with the reach of this rule down to speakers who spend at least as $25, that is, grassroots speakers. And I think that a limiting construction doesn't work in this case, Justice Crooks, because it needs to be fairly inferable from the language of the rule itself. And a grassroots speaker will not be able to look at this rule and tell whether or not his proposed issue advocacy, his decision to put together some T-shirts which criticize Governor Walker for accepting money from the Koch brothers, or a blogger who spends more than $25 for an internet connection and then wants to make a post which criticizes the activities of some of the campaign ads of some public official. All of these speakers, all of these very, very small speakers, are going to run the risk of being subject to the rule and being subject potentially to criminal penalties if they guess wrong.
Do we have to throw out the whole rule in order to avoid that problem?
I think we have to tell the Government Accountability Board that it needs to go back and start again. The concern here that everyone has, obviously, is about millions of dollars being spent for campaign advertisements for, you know, mass media. Media buys, broadcast, satellite, cable, and the need for the public to know who's paying for those. But this rule, it seems to me, goes way too far, both with respect to its departure from express advocacy, which is very, very easy in the old realm of the magic words, is very, very easy to a speaker to know whether or not he or she has crossed that line. And also, and becomes even more problematic when the rule is applied to people who spend as little as $25 to speak, because it doesn't take that much to spend $25. I mean, all of us who come in here to the Capitol walk past every day, or at least most days, at least when I've been here, a group of people who have made T-shirts and passed out song sheets and are singing songs in the Capitol Rotunda. I have no confidence that this rule doesn't apply.
Mr. Essenberg,
yes?
What kind of limiting and limitations are you talking about? Justice Crooks says, can you limit this? GAB, right? I want to know what kind of limitation you're talking about.
I'm not talking about, I suggest here that there is no limiting construction that this court ought to adopt, that this is a case like
what
Wisconsin.
What about limiting it only to express advocacy?
One would have to rewrite the rule in order to do that, because the in both emergency GAB 128 and GAB as originally promulgated, there is a rather serious departure from the definition of express advocacy as it was promulgated in WRLT-2. In the original rule,
WR2's definition of express advocacy?
Of express advocacy, that something can be regarded as express advocacy only if it is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate.
Isn't that the exact words, or very close to the exact words of the rule?
Those exact words are in the rule, but the rule doesn't stop there. As the rule is originally promulgated, it goes on to then create a conclusive presumption that a communication which refers to a candidate and then proceeds to discuss his or her character or qualities or position on public issues or public public record is conclusively presumed to be.
Suppose the court knocked that out as invalid.
I think that the court should knock that out as invalid.
Then you're left with words that are only susceptible to express advocacy.
Except that in the revised version of the rule, that is the rule which is the emergency rule that is currently pending, the GAB once again moves beyond the permissible definition of express advocacy, and it takes WRTL standard, which is exclusive, right, only things that are susceptible of no other interpretation may be considered express advocacy, and it sets up an alternative where WRTL2 brooks no alternative. Pardon?
What's the alternative?
The alternative in the disjunctive is any communication which uses particular words or their functional equivalent and unambiguously relates to the campaign. Now, the problem there is several-fold. First of all, these express words or their functional equivalent are no more than words of support or opposition. Their functional equivalents will often be found in issue advocacy, which, after all, will almost always call for people to take a position for or against something. Because it sets up this standard as a disjunctive, we know it then replaces the requirement that it call for the election or defeat of a candidate or relate to the election of a defeat or a candidate to the requirement that it unambiguously relates to the campaign. Relates means associate or connected, and I don't know what relates to the campaign means. With all due respect to the GAB, I've been practicing law for 30 years. I've taught election law. I've published scholarly work in this area in some of the leading law journals in the country, and I don't know what it means to ambiguously relate to the campaign. Does it mean that the communication has to be intended to affect the campaign? That's a plausible reading of that rule, but it's one that's constitutionally impermissible under Wisconsin Right to Life because they rejected an intent-based standard.
Okay, let's take a look. I want to make sure that we're not conflating things. Your challenge is not to Chapter 11, the statute. Your challenge is to 1.28.
That's right.
When you talk about the $25 limitation and the T-shirts and stuff, all of that existed before 1.28 was amended in July of 2010 because it's in Chapter 11, but you're not attacking Chapter 11. So whether or not you agree that 25 is a reasonable limit for T-shirts or, you pick whatever sign you want, that's not the issue because you're not attacking that. That existed before this rule was in effect.
I disagree that it's not an issue, and here's why. And in this event, respect, I think that the McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission decision in the United States Supreme Court is instructive. These things work together.
But you're not challenging Chapter 11.
True, but okay. GAB 128 takes Chapter 11's $25 limitation and now applies it to issue advocacy. This affects the constitutional analysis. Because we know that with respect to issue advocacy, the state has a much weaker interest in regulation. Right? The Supreme Court has made clear that there is independent issue advocacy does not raise the specter of corruptions such that speech can be regulated. WRTL and Citizens United rejected an anti-distortion rationale. The only thing we have left is the informational interest. The informational interest, as it applies to pure issue advocacy, and to people who spend as little as $25, is relatively weak. I would suggest to be non-existent.
Your premise, your argument is premised on if it is issue advocacy. If we took out those two sentences that you are concerned about in B, and left only the language from Wisconsin Right to Life 2 that was again reiterated in Citizens United as the first sentence. Isn't it clearly advocacy?
If, in fact, we returned to the language of 128 before it was amended, which would require striking the amendment that was in the conclusive presumption in the original statute, and the alternative, that is this requirement or this definition in the disjunctive of language of a communication which has language of support or opposition and that applies only to it unambiguously relates to the campaign, then we'd be back to 128 as it existed prior to the initiation of this lawsuit. And, of course, there wouldn't be a lawsuit because there would have been no amendment.
Let's take B. You know, we've got sub B of 128.3. That first sentence, and we were discussing that earlier, reads, "The communication is susceptible of no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a specific candidate." Are you able? I didn't want to get ahead of you. You have that.
No, I'm good. Thanks. Yeah.
That's language right from Roberts' opinion in Wisconsin Right to Life, too. So what's wrong with that language?
What's wrong with that is the second sentence of subparagraph
B. First sentence is no problem, though. Is that correct?
Pardon?
That first sentence that I read, which was language right from Wisconsin Right to Life, too.
The first sentence is not a problem. It was in the rule before we brought this lawsuit.
3B was in the rule before you brought the lawsuit. That was added in July 2010.
Right, but the language which essentially limited the scope of the rule to express advocacy, and I would argue that this no reasonable interpretation standard is essentially the equivalent of the magic word standard. Seven justices in Wisconsin Right to Life thought so.
Okay.
If we stick to that, then we essentially have 128 as it was originally enacted.
This part of the amendment you have no objection to then.
Right. The problem is the addition of the second sentence or the addition of the alternative basis for regulating speech in a revised, in the emergency form of 128.
You're not of the opinion, are you, that you need magic words in order to have express advocacy?
It's hard for me to imagine, given Justice, and this, Justice Bradley, is a personal opinion. It's hard for me to imagine Chief Justice Roberts' definition of express advocacy applying to a communication which doesn't have the traditional magic words or which isn't pretty close to that. Because he makes clear that the tie goes to the speaker, that there is that a lengthy contextual analysis is not to be permitted, no discovery should be had. And as I said before, and I have to say that I told this to students once, that in Wisconsin Right to Life, seven justices of the Wisconsin Supreme Court thought that McConnell's teaching had been overruled, and that when you have any proposition of law in which Justices Scalia and Thomas on the one hand and Ginsburg and Stevens on the other hand agree, that it's probably true as a matter of the law of physics. That it seems to me that Wisconsin Right to Life...
which law
there's a possibility that it might apply to something that doesn't include those express words, but I think that there's probably not a lot of room given given Chief Justice Roberts' language.
Well, as I recall, the Elections Board versus WMC, that was the opinion in 1999 of the seven justices of this court, that all of us agreed that you don't need the magic words, that there can be the functional equivalent of magic words. Do you disagree with that part of that rather split decision?
No, I don't disagree with that, although I would point out that at the time, and Justice Crook's opinion points out in WMC, that there was relatively little guidance from the United States Supreme Court with respect to express advocacy at the time that the WMC case itself was decided. Since then, we've had the McConnell, Wisconsin Right to Life, Citizens United trilogy. And it seems to me that the teaching of those cases make clear that while it may be permissible to have a standard which says, susceptible of no reasonable interpretation, other, the conclusive presumption of the second sentence of subparagraph B is impermissible, and the alternative version in the emergency rule, which applies this proscription or this regulatory scheme to communications which are something other than communications that are susceptible of no reasonable interpretation otherwise it wouldn't be in the disjunctive, then that is no longer permissible.
What's wrong with a limiting instruction? In fact, when we look at these cases, oftentimes we start our examination back with Buckley. There may be others, but in modern day we start with Buckley. And Buckley had that as part of the analytical framework, discussing, first of all, a limiting instruction. I mean, that was part of the analysis. That's the way you approach these cases. And as I recall then, they ended up saying, nevertheless, even when there is a limiting instruction, they concluded that the independent expenditure ceiling
I think for the same reason that the court in WMC told the Elections Board to go back and start all over again, because particularly grassroots speakers, people that are making T-shirts, painting barns, putting together signs, don't have and shouldn't be required, the United States Supreme Court has made clear, to lawyer up. And in the absence of some direction in the statute, in the rule itself, if we have this language which appears to apply to the type of speech in which they intend to engage, then we have, in the words of the WMC decision in the First Amendment context, a number of different problems. We have the problem of unfair or discriminatory enforcement. We have the problem, most fundamentally, of speakers being deterred, because if they look at this rule, it appears that anything that they do, all the people who are out on the Capitol lawn, you know, during the spring and who held up signs, you know, talking about recalling Governor Walker or supporting Governor Walker or whatever it is that they did, if they spent more than $25, then, you know, they're subject to these reporting, registration, accounting, disclaimer, identification, and fee requirements. And McIntyre makes clear that when we're talking about issue advocacy and when we're talking about grassroots speakers, that even the compelled identification of a speaker is unconstitutional, that that's overly burdensome. And so as I said when I started, this is an example of a rule that goes too far. And GIB needs to be told to go back and do it again, particularly in light of the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, this is a rule that will be enforced not only by the Governmental Accountability Board, and we all know that they consist of, you know, five distinguished judges, but by any district attorney in the state, subject to whatever political vagaries that person is is subject to. This becomes a tool for political combat. It becomes a trap for the unwary, and all because it goes too far. We're concerned about one thing. We're concerned about millions of dollars being spent on attack ads, and in order to do that, we've cast a net that goes too far, including issue advocacy and these little speakers.
No, you always wind up maybe in the beginning, middle, and end of issue advocacy. And that seems to be your really strongest point. Rather than dealing with, can this be limited to express advocacy and what are the defects in this if it's express advocacy? Because all the defects you mention are statutory. And the original rule, you say, would cover only express advocacy, right? And you're not challenging that. So it seems to me your argument has to be that to the extent this is interpreted as more than express advocacy, you have problems. And some of the problems you mention would seem to be, to me, an as applied rather than a facial. And you have different standards of review and different issues.
I think that there is room here for an as-applied challenge as it pertains to express advocacy. But with respect to the rule,
you haven't made that.
No, we haven't made that.
And there's a debate about the facts if you make of
that.
That's
right. But the rule, the rule as it's promulgated here, and my time has expired. But if I may be permitted just to finish the thought, is that. That the definitions, either in the original GAB or the second GAB rule, are such that not only do I believe that they apply to issue advocacy, but a speaker would have no way of knowing whether or not the issue advocacy in which he or she wishes to engage is covered by the rule because of the breadth. That is, it's a facial challenge, but it's a challenge based upon overbreadth and void for vagueness.
And the precise words that you think are overbroad are?
The second sentence of sub B.
Which is?
That the creates the irrebuttable presumption, right? A communication.
Okay. But if that is gone, what's your objection?
Then we have the revised version of the rule, which may or may not come into effect. We don't know yet. Right. And that rule creates an alternative.
So that's not before the court?
We had supplemental briefing at that point. We have the state taking the position that, well, you know, we shouldn't worry about the second sentence because we've amended the rule. Well, but the amended rule isn't okay either because the amended rule offers an alternative to the no reasonable interpretation other than standard, one that combines words of support not with the election or defeat of a candidate, but with this sort of broader notion of unambiguously relating to. And I think that that's overly broad. That goes beyond the definition of express advocacy that was approved in Wisconsin Right to Life. And either as a matter of state law, it goes beyond Chapter 11, or is unconstitutional, particularly as applied to grassroots speakers.
Thank you. I think that's a good summary of your basic point in the argument. Thank you. Counsel, Assistant Attorney General Thomas Bellavia.
May it please the Court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Thomas Bellavia, and with me at council table is Assistant Attorney General Clayton Koski. We represent the state respondents in this matter, who are the members and the executive director of the Wisconsin Government Accountability Board. During petitioner's counsel's remarks, I heard some statements about the history of just what this rule is and what it does that I think I don't agree with. So I'd like to start by just clarifying the background of this and the purpose of this rule as I understand it. In Chapter 11 of our statutes, our legislature has found that the people of the state have a compelling interest in requiring disclosure of information about who is making or paying for communications that seek to influence elections. And to advance that informational interest, the statutes impose a variety of disclosure requirements on communications for a political purpose. Political purpose is defined in the statutes in part as including but not limited to communications that expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate for public office. This is background. It's true prior to 2010. The pre-2010 version of the rule that's at issue here interpreted that statutory definition of political purpose in a way that only reached communications that use express terminology of electoral advocacy, the magic words from Buckley. What is currently Section 3A of GAB 1.28, prior to 2010.
That's Buckley, footnote 52.
Footnote 52 precisely. Of Buckley, correct.
Okay.
What is currently Section 3A was previously in the rule, but was Section 2C of the rule prior to 2010. Not identical, but the magic words part, the list of the magic words was there. Some of the wording was changed as we
now, was the original have the words that Mr. Essenberg is objecting to unambiguously relates to the campaign of that candidate?
I'm going to look because I don't want to get that wrong.
It's all right. I had a lot of papers, and half of them are back in the chambers.
Unambiguously relates was already
already
in
that.
Was
he's
already
not a
in what was what the way in which it was changed was by deleting from the former 2C the phrase that expressly advocates the election or defeat of that candidate. And one of the arguments that petitioners have made in their brief
that's
on the merits
unambiguously relates is different.
Is that if unambiguously relates was already there and is,
okay,
and is still there. Unambiguously relates, I would note also, is language that comes straight out of Buckley.
Okay.
In the discussion of this issue in Buckley, the court explained that they were concerned that the federal disclosure statute at issue there had constitutional vagueness problems. To avoid those problems, it said you have to construe it, saving interpretation. It can only apply to communications that are sufficiently closely related to a candidate's campaign.
Right.
That means they use these magic words, or at least or something like them, and they use them with reference to a clearly identified candidate. And if it does those things, then it unambiguously relates to the campaign of the candidate, and that eliminates, that avoids the vagueness concern. So unambiguously relates to the campaign comes from Buckley.
Also, I want to stay on 128.3a, because other than those proverbial two sentences in B that we've been talking about, 3a seems the focus or a large part of the argument here at oral argument today by your opposing counsel. So I don't want to go through it word for word. What was added in July of 2010 is, as I understand in A language, the communication contains. Is that correct? That was added?
That was added.
And then terms such as the following or their functional equivalents with reference to a clearly identified candidate, that comes right from Buckley language. Is that correct? And that was also in the original?
That was definitely in the pre-2010 version. I'm hesitating about the reference to whether that comes directly from Buckley, because I'm not sure if I can't remember if footnote 52 in Buckley said functional equivalence or
that
not.
That is the construction. You can read it up against it. Would restrict the application of 608E1 to communications containing express words of advocacy of election or defeat, such as vote for, elect, support, cast your ballot for, Smith for Congress, it's changed to Smith for Assembly, vote against, defeat, reject. That's Buckley.
I think such as is the language in the Buckley footnote.
That's right.
That is construed as meaning that it doesn't, it's not strictly limited to those exact words.
It includes but not limited to.
That's what's covered in our rule by functional equivalence as used in 3A.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's okay. So the examples in 3A are virtually out of Buckley also. Is that correct?
I checked them, and they are correspond point by point to the magic words from Buckley footnote.
And the language that was complained of by your opposing counsel unambiguously relates was in the original 1.28 and is language that comes right out of Buckley. Is that correct?
Counselor, if you would go back to the statute and the definition of political purpose, and if in a hypothetical situation someone were charged with violating some of the requirements of Chapter 11 and what was necessary to prove was that it was done for the purpose of influencing an election, how would you determine whether the actor had acted for the purpose of influencing an election?
I don't think, and the interveners might not agree with me on this point, I don't think that the phrase from the statutory definition that refers to the purpose of influencing election would or should be applied just by itself. That phrase is supplemented by a lot more in the rule that's at issue here.
Right,
there's an argument, the influencing an election language was present in the disclosure statute that was at issue in Buckley and was part of the language that gave rise to the court's vagueness concerns in that case.
That may be, but I want you to just focus on the statute, and we're all arguing about the GAB rule. And my question remains, if as a district attorney you were prosecuting someone for a violation of the statute and you had to prove that it was done, quote, the act was done for the purpose of influencing an election or a vote or a recall, how would you prove that the actor did a particular act for the purpose of influencing?
I would look at the communication. If I were the district attorney, I would look at the communication and I would ask whether that communication expressly advocates the election or defeat of that candidate, or whether it is susceptible of no other reasonable interpretation.
But you're giving standards, Counselor. I want you to be a trial lawyer for a minute. I don't want you to be an appellate lawyer that deals in standards of law. I want to know how physically, if you had this person charged and they were in a courtroom, what kind of facts would you be putting together to show that this person's acts were done for the purpose of influencing an election or a vote or whatever? What kind of facts?
I would primarily look to the content of the communication itself that was at issue, because I think that the case law is very clear that if any reliance on the context of the communication is permissible, it's a very limited reliance. Petitioner's counsel mentioned that discovery has been discouraged, if not forbidden. So I would remain primarily on the content of the communication in question.
Okay, and so one of the things that you would have to show by whatever facts you would put together, perhaps an exhibit that showed the content of the communication, as you suggest, you'd have to show that the actor did whatever he did for the purpose of influence an election or a vote, correct?
Yes, but the statute also says that political purpose includes a communication that contains express advocacy. So if I looked at the content and the communication did contain that, then the statute provides that the legislature has said that is for a political purpose within the meaning of that statute. So that communication would fall within the statute.
Okay. And so it was, you, you've got someone who is alleged to have violated the statute. You're going to have to prove that what he did for the political purpose of influencing a vote, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you have to determine what this person did and what his motivation was. If it was somehow innocently transmitted or innocently put together, then the purpose really wouldn't have been for influencing a vote or influencing an election, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite hear the question there. Excuse
okay.
me.
Well, the statute says that an act is for a political purpose if it's done for a specific purpose by the actor. And I think you and I have gotten beyond that. Okay. So if someone has violated the statute as a district attorney, you'd have to show that what communications they made were not inadvertently done. Somehow a message they expected to stay within the four walls of their office got distributed. Correct? You'd have to show that it was distributed. The act was done for the purpose of influencing an election.
Okay,
so if it was innocently done, then you don't come within the kind of act we are concerned about in Chapter 11, correct?
I think that's right.
Okay. Now, if you go forward with that and you look at the GAB rule, the test that is set out in the GAB rule, even one that Mr. Essenberg agrees with, is a communication that is susceptible to no reasonable interpretation other than as an appeal to vote for or against a candidate, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And if you look at the first part, which is Section A, it says the communication contains such terms as the following or their functional equivalent. So that functional equivalent language comes out of Wisconsin Right to Life and is used again in Citizens United, correct?
I think the phrase functional equivalence is in Wisconsin Right to Life. I don't think that the functional equivalence as it's used in 3A is the same as functional equivalence as it was used in Wisconsin Right to Life.
How about in Citizens United? They talk about the same term.
I don't remember how that phrase was used. I thought they were used. It was used the same as in Wisconsin Right to Life.
Well,
the way I see that, when like as I mentioned earlier to Chief Justice Abrahamson, in footnote 52 of Buckley, where the magic words are listed, it says such as the following, meaning that it was a non-exclusive list. That means that other words that are equivalent to those words could be added to that list. That's what's referred to here as functional equivalent.
Counselor, with the term functional equivalent. I'm not concerned with the list. I'm concerned with the word functional equivalent. And that was looked at in the first time that I can recall reading it, though it may have been elsewhere, is in Wisconsin Right to Life. They somehow set that up when they started talking about there not being magic words. Do you recall that?
Yes.
Okay. And then in Citizens United, when they were looking at the test for Hillary, they talked again about something being the functional equivalent of express advocacy, correct?
Correct.
And in both of those cases, they specifically say that the functional equivalent is an objective standard, correct?
Correct.
Okay. But if you're going to prove that someone violated Chapter 11 under the terminology set forth that you and I just reviewed, you're applying a subjective standard. The test is, what was the purpose of the actor, correct?
I think that purpose, as used in the definition of political purpose, can be construed as an objective standard and not just what was the subjective intent. However,
Have you ever heard of a criminal statute that convicts someone of a crime based on somebody else's purpose other than the actor's purpose?
No.
Okay. And this has criminal penalties that go along with violating it, correct?
Yes.
So you wouldn't be telling me that you could convict someone of a violation based on an objective standard, which is the reasonable man standard, would you?
I think not.
Okay. Thank you.
If I may just say
one more response to
the point is, I think that the position that you've outlined in your questions, if it proves what it proves, if it proves something, is that the definition of political purpose in 1101 sub 16 is constitutionally problematic, but not that the rule that's challenged in this case is constitutional.
All of that I may agree with you, but that's not the question that's before the court. I think the position that was set up by opposing counsel is that there is an overreaching by the GAB. Well, GAB overreaches when it goes beyond the statute. That's at least what the case law suggests. Now, maybe the statute has some problems. Nobody's argued that to us. But I do think that whatever rules the GAB writes, they have to be within the confines of the statute, or perhaps maybe inform the legislature that they need to look at the statute. But to me, a subjective test is a very different test from an objective test.
But counsel, I wonder if you would focus on 16A1
okay.
of the statute. This is in relation to Justice Rogensack's questions. It says, acts which are for political purposes include the making of a communication which expressly advocates the election, defeat, recall, or retention of a clearly identified candidate. Do you view 3A as within A1?
Yes.
Okay. My next question is, because you're going to run out of time, as I understand your brief, which may not be what you're saying, you say that this GAB 128 is limited to express advocacy, not issue advocacy. Is that correct?
That is correct, as long as express advocacy includes the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Yes.
That's where you differ from WEAC. I understand that, but you don't have to answer that. But
I think that's
you,
right.
this, you limit this to express advocacy.
Correct.
Within, now I may miss one of the cases, Buckley, Right to Life, McConnell, Citizens United.
That being said, counsel, can you see at least the grounds for the concern of your opposing counsel in regard to the deletion in 3A, where it used to read, the communication contains terms such as the following or their functional equivalents with reference to a clearly identified candidate that expressly advocates the election or defeat of that candidate and that unambiguously relates to the campaign of that candidate. By striking out the phrase, quote, that expressly advocates the election or defeat of that candidate, does that not at least raise some grounds for concerns of opposing counsel that it starts to regulate issue advocacy?
It certainly opens the door to that argument, and it could raise that concern. I think that if one reads what is left in the rule and looks at what is left says, I don't think that the concern is a real one. I think that what's left is limited to express advocacy. If it's not, if striking the words expressly advocates did in fact broaden that provision, which we say it did not do, then the appropriate response would be to do what the Supreme Court did in Buckley, which is to read an express advocacy limitation into that provision, that is to invalidate the line that's drawn through that phrase, not to invalidate the 2010 amendments in their entirety, but to eliminate that line. If the court were to do that, I think it would be unnecessary to do that because I think the standard that's there is okay. If you did do it, I don't think it changes the meaning of that paragraph as GAB interprets it. So it's a harmless correction as far as I'm concerned.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, and may it please the Court. I am Matthew O'Neill of Fox, O'Neill & Shannon, and I am representing the interveners in this action, Mary Bell and WEAC. As the Chief Justice picked up, we do have a different view of this case, and in fact, we believe all of this discussion to date has missed one fundamental legal precept, and that is that the Supreme Court in McConnell and the Supreme Court again in Citizens United explicitly said that in the realm of disclosure provisions, which is all that's at issue here, this concept of issue advocacy versus express advocacy is out the window. In McConnell, they said they rejected the notion that the First Amendment requires Congress to treat so-called issue advocacy differently from express advocacy. In Citizens United, they said, quote, "We reject Citizens United's contention that the disclosure requirements must be limited to speech that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy." Wisconsin Right to Life had nothing to do with disclosure. The only thing at issue in that case was the outright ban on corporate expenditures. And what the court held is, in that context, a ban on speech and even a limit on speech, that it needs to be limited to the functional equivalent of express advocacy. But it did not talk about disclosure, and the court could not have been clearer in McConnell and in Citizens United that when you're talking about disclosure, which is all that's at issue here, the distinction between issue advocacy and express advocacy is irrelevant. Going back to the history here, it's our position that GAB had a duty to look back and reform GAB 1.28 after McConnell and after Citizens United to ensure that it was not limited solely to express advocacy. For this reason, Section 11.001 and Section 11.002 identify and make clear that there is a First Amendment right of the public to have the maximum amount of information with respect to who is supporting who in the context of an election that is constitutionally allowable. And the Elections Board and then the Government Accountability Board has tracked the constitutional development throughout the years. 1976, Buckley was decided. They said it had to be express advocacy in terms of the FECA standard that was relate to. And everybody, including this court, read that to mean that the definition of political purpose could only apply to communications that fell within that definition of express advocacy. The Elections Board, in an emergency rule, created 1.28 and said Chapter 11 applies only to acts of express advocacy. Fast forward to the decision by this court in WMC, where the Elections Board was trying to enforce an express advocacy standard that included contextual factors. This court said, you may be able to do that, or you may not, but you can't do it without telling the speaker beforehand what the standard is. And so they sent it back and said, it's up for you, Elections Board, or you, legislature, either one, to engage in further rulemaking or lawmaking and decide what express advocacy means. The Elections Board then went back and they added to 1.28 the standard that said it applies to the magic words or their functional equivalents. That's how that got in there. In 2007, Wisconsin Act 1 created the Government Accountability Board, and among other things, told that board, go back and review all of the Elections Board rules and either repeal them, reform them, or restate them. So they had to go back and look at 1.28, and what they found out when they did was that in McConnell, in 2002, the court had come out and said, whoa, this express advocacy, issue advocacy distinction is not constitutionally required. While they were in the process of redoing the rules, Citizens United came out and reiterated the same point. And in that context, also Wisconsin Right to Life was decided. And so the GAB, consistent with its duty to reform this particular rule and its duty to make sure that the rule got maximum disclosure to the public of things that were allowable to have disclosed related to an election, revised the rule. And they put in place subsection 3A, which did not create any new standard about something being unambiguously related to a campaign. As Your Honor pointed out, that was in the pre-existing rule. The only thing they did was take out the words that expressly advocates. And again, that's entirely consistent with what the Supreme Court said in McConnell and the Supreme Court said in Citizens United.
Counsel, do you think 1.28 regulates issue advocacy?
It's a difficult question. I think, first of all, I don't think the distinction of whether it does or doesn't is controlling in any way, because it's just disclosure. But it goes into that realm of arguing what's issue and what's express. And courts have had a lot of difficulty in figuring out what that is. But I think theoretically it could. I think the creative arguers of law school professors and other lawyers can conjure up situations that could fall within 3A and perhaps be what used to be referred to as issue advocacy. Do I think those are reasonable hypotheticals? I don't.
Mr. O'Neill, does that mean that you would oppose any kind of limiting instruction or construction in this situation? In other words, is your position contrary to that of the GAB at this point?
Oppose is too strong a word. I don't think it's required. I think the rule as written is consistent with the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in McConnell and in Citizens United that in the context of disclosure only, there's no need to distinguish between express advocacy and issue advocacy on a constitutional level. Every court to deal with disclosure requirements after Citizens United has reached the same conclusion, including the First Circuit, including the Ninth Circuit, including courts, district courts from Iowa, from Hawaii, from Illinois. They have all actually not had much of a problem with this issue. They've looked at that and said, oh, it's just disclosure. It's exacting scrutiny. It's not strict scrutiny. We don't need to bother with whether it's issue or whether it's express. It's okay.
Well, is it only disclosure? Is it filing, paying a $100 fee, which the statute provides? I mean, you've got other things than disclosure. This is not only disclosure.
Well, it's registration, reporting,
registration,
disclosure.
Reporting.
Courts have lumped those all into disclosure, and I didn't mean to suggest it was only the disclaimer requirement 11.30. It does include all of those. Those are all in the statutes. The statutes aren't being challenged. The $25 threshold is in the statutes. It has been since 1973. If you ask me, is that still a relevant number? No, it should be higher, but that's a legislative, not a court determination. In several of these cases since then, the threshold's been $100. That's what it was in Brumsickle, that's what it was in McKee, that's what it was in Yamada, that's what it was in the Minnesota case. So $25 or $100, I don't think that gets you past the heavy burden of a facial challenge to a properly promulgated rule as being unconstitutional.
Counselor, does the Supreme Court's overruling of Austin in Citizens United have any effect on your ability to rely on McConnell, which relied very heavily on Austin?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, and for this reason, because the only thing at issue that comes into play from the application of Government Accountability Rule GAB 1.28 is disclosure. And in Citizens United, there were two aspects of the case, and the first aspect was the ban on corporate speech, and they said, Austin, you're gone. And then the second part of the case, they said, but disclosure, it's fine. Same decision. And they made a sharp distinction between limits on the one hand, or prohibitions, and disclosure requirements. And they specifically, and this is a quote, for these reasons, we reject Citizens United's contention that the disclosure requirements must be limited to speech that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy.
Counsel, even if you're right on that, I mean, you're quoting right from Citizens United, so that's, I've read that quote. But you have the problem with the GAB cannot promulgate a rule that it is not statutorily authorized to promulgate.
Correct.
And an argument is advanced. I think the GAB embraces this in terms of its legislative, I use that term loosely, history. that when you're dealing with Chapter 11, you're dealing with regulation of express advocacy. Now, I don't want to misstate the GAB's position, but it seems to me that there's express advocacy that is regulated in Chapter 11, and the statement of the GAB, I think, with regard to 1.28, looked to me like it was express advocacy that they were interested in regulating, not issue advocacy. So where do you get the authority statutorily to promulgate a rule that may cover issue advocacy, even if constitutionally with regard to disclosure it's allowed?
Chapter 11 does not restrict, by its terms, does not restrict its application to express advocacy. It just doesn't. After Buckley was decided and 11.01.16 was amended to include reference to express advocacy, it was not done on an exclusive basis. Subsection A of 11.01.16 says acts which are for political purposes include but are not limited to. And this court, or was it the Court of Appeals, I forget, in one of the cases that cited in the brief said that language makes clear that statutorily speaking, Chapter 11 is not strictly limited to express advocacy. It's not. That is include but are not limited to. So the authority of the GAB comes from 5.051F and from 227.11 that allows that board to interpret and implement the provisions of Chapter 11, including 11.01.16, that requires them to determine when acts are for political purposes or for the purpose of influencing an election. And I want to make one final point in response to Justice Rogentek's questioning to Mr. Bellavia about the criminal statute. Right. The criminal violation would not be of 11.01.16. One would not be going to jail for making a political purpose act. In 11.61, the criminal provisions apply for an intentional violation of this chapter, including 11.05 and other provisions. So the prosecution would be for a failure to report. The intent requirement of the law would require that the speaker knew that they were required to make a disclosure but failed to.
I understand that. My purpose was not so much to juxtapose a criminal prosecution, but to try to get counsel to agree that one was really setting out a subjective standard and another an objective standard, which to me are quite different.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have a question for you. In looking to see whether there's power for issue versus express advocacy, I look at the next to the last sentence in 11.001 subsection 1, which is the declaration of policy, which says such a system, and that is disclosing contributions and disbursements, must make readily available to the voters complete information as to who is supporting or opposing which candidate or cause. And that's issue to me.
I agree with you. I read 11.01.
Well, where else do you find the words cause?
I don't find it anywhere else, but I don't find anything in Chapter 11 limiting it to express advocacy.
You find nothing in Chapter 11? What about the exemptions set forth in 11.062 with regard to registration or, let's say, the oath committees and individuals who desire to make disbursements to advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. I mean, isn't that just another way of saying express advocacy?
It is. And if you look at the state's position, what they say is the only thing that's brought into play by 1.28 are the applicable requirements of Chapter 11. And in the state's purview, because 11.06 sub 2, and that was 11.06 sub 7 you were just reading from, because those two subsections specifically refer to express advocacy, that a speaker, if they fell on what they believe to be the issue side of things, wouldn't be subject to those. You won't find that language in 11.30, so likely there would need to be disclaimer. So those of us who drive down the road and they see a now anonymous billboard that says something that's clearly what most people believe is political and probably would be subject to no other reasonable interpretation, it will now say paid for by X, Y, and Z.
And that's what issues that were covered in your brief, that everything doesn't automatically flow, even if it covers issue advocacy, in the rest of Chapter 11.
Right.
Are there any other questions? Hearing none,
thank you
very much, Mr. O'Neill. Mr. Essenberg?
Let me begin by responding to a few of the things that Mr. O'Neill said. First of all, it seems to me that the question of whether Chapter 11 is limited to express advocacy is one that is quite readily answered. If we look at the purpose language in Section 11.001, it repeatedly refers to influencing elections and campaigns. There is reference, one sole reference to the word cause, but I would suggest to you that consistent with the definition of political purpose, which is also limited to candidates and elections, that the term cause there refers to referendum. This court in WMC made quite clear there was nobody who disagreed that none of the six justices who participated thought that Chapter 11 applied to anything other than express advocacy. The sole issue before the court there was whether or not the Elections Board could take a context-based approach to determining what issue express advocacy was, and concluded that it could not because that would be tantamount to express rulemaking and wouldn't provide adequate notice to speakers as to what was and was not covered. With respect to the constitutionality of applying the rule to issue advocacy, I don't think this Court needs to reach that because of the statute's limitation, but I think it would be a mistake to read Citizens United as saying that the state has an interest, an informational interest, in requiring all speakers to disclose, notwithstanding the amount of money that they spend on advocacy. Applying this rule to speakers who spend as little as $25 provides no significant informational information to the voters of this state. And, in fact, we know that because of the United States Supreme Court's decision in McIntyre versus Ohio Elections Commission, where the court struck down a prohibition in Ohio against anonymous leafleting. And the court noted in the course of doing that, that when we're dealing with issue advocacy and when we're dealing with grassroots speakers, the interest of the state in regulating, even requiring disclosure of the source of the speech in question, is much more limited. Now,
Counsel, before this 1.28 was amended, you still had grassroots demonstrators. Now, that's just not a recent phenomenon. And you had the limitation, as set the $25 limitation that you've referred to now several times, that was set out for those, let's say, arguably, who engage in express advocacy, even if they're grassroots. I mean, that existed a long time ago. You're not objecting to a $25 limitation for grassroots folks who engage in express advocacy, are you?
It's one thing that, well, I might, but not as part of this case.
Legislature decides that. The
distinction here, though, is that it used to be the case prior to these amendments that it didn't take a rocket scientist to tell whether one was engaged in express advocacy or not. One would pretty much have to use words which expressly advocated the election or defeat of a candidate. Now we have amendments to Section 3A, which, yes, I understand that unambiguously related comes from Buckley, and those magic words were in Buckley. But they were authorized for use in Buckley only in conjunction with their use in the course of expressly advocating the election or defeat of a candidate. 3A has now been amended to take out the requirement that they expressly advocate the election or a defeat of a candidate, I think, at minimum, leaving that provision void for vagueness. And it's not...
Well, if the court interprets that to include expressly advocate, does that defeat your argument?
It would make the argument a little bit weaker, but there's still a problem in the sense that the rule sets up a disjunctive. 3B adopts the standard in Wisconsin right to life, and 3A promulgates some other standard, which is presumably, because it's in the disjunctive, something other than the standard set forth in Wisconsin right to life, notwithstanding the fact that the Supreme Court has told us that that standard is the only standard for the definition of express advocacy.
Essenberg, I don't want to be thick, and I don't want to miss your argument. Where is the alternative?
The alternative is in 3A. If we look at 3B, 3B
says... Where is the alternative in 3A?
3B says, 128.3 says that a communication is for a political purpose if either of the following applies.
Okay, so you're objecting to either, and you don't read B as interpreting A. Is that your point?
No, because as a matter of punctuation and grammar, they are in the disjunctive.
Okay.
They are either or.
All right. Finally, dug you. Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, want to thank Mr. Essenberg, Mr. Bellavia, and Mr. O'Neill for your excellent arguments today on a very difficult constitutional and statutory interpretation issues. That concludes our argument on 10 AP 1937-OA, Wisconsin Prosperity Network versus Gordon Mize. Court is in... recess until tomorrow, when we will have oral argument at 9:45. The court will meet in closed conference at 3:15. We are in recess.